So I have an important question to ask all of you out there, a question that I'm pretty sure will resonate with you because it sure resonated and resonates with me. When was the last time that you went to bed before midnight without a phone lighting up your face like a campfire? I got to tell you, for me, until recently, it had been a pretty long time. And I will also tell you that nothing, literally nothing, pairs worse with a good night's sleep than the latest news cycle running on an infinite loop inside your head. The stress and the screen time do more than just make you crazy. They raise your core body temperature, and a body that's too warm just can't get into deep restorative sleep. That explains a lot, right? You're not just exhausted from the news itself. You're tired because your body never actually recovered. The answer is your bed temperature, and that's where the ChiliPad 2.0 comes in. This water-based topper fits your existing mattress and actively pulls heat away from your body. It's like jumping into a refreshing cold pool versus just moving hot air around with a fan. The new 2.0 is quieter than its predecessor. It features a premium washable cover and includes a nightstand remote with sensors that trigger your sleep schedule the moment you hit the sheets. There are dual zones for partners and zero, count them, zero subscriptions. Setting the My Sleep environment to stay cool has finally ended all of my 3 a.m. tossing and turning. Go to www.sleep.me/impolitic to get up to $255 off your ChiliPad 2.0 with code impolitic. That's www.sleep.me/impolitic. Free shipping, free returns, and a 30-night trial so you can test it out. Dream big and wake up better. Not just better, but way better. The headlines will still be there in the morning. So when you wake up, you might as well meet them ready, rested, and refreshed. Aloha, namaste, and welcome to Impolitic with John Heilman, a Puck and Odyssey joint. With the midterm elections now less than 4 months off, looming increasingly large on the political horizon and weighing ever more heavily on the minds of every incumbent congressperson, House and Senate alike, who's running in a contested race this year, but in particular on the minds of Republicans, whose party is consistently trailing by large and growing numbers on the generic ballot tests and every remotely reliable poll, one consistent theme pops up in the conversations that I have on a daily basis with those candidates, the people who work for them, top drawer strategists in both parties, and my fellow journalistic hacks. If you look at Donald Trump's behavior since the start of the calendar year and judge it just on the basis of the clear and predictable political ramifications of what he's said, what he's done, what he's prioritized or highlighted, and what, on the other hand, he hasn't said, hasn't done, and has chosen to downplay or ignore altogether, you could be forgiven for coming to the conclusion that Trump's central, overarching objective is to guarantee that his own party is doomed to have its collective keister kicked from here to Sunday, this coming November 3rd. Now, let me just state for the record that I'm not saying I actually believe that Trump is actively trying to tank the congressional wing of the GOP, but on the face of it, the evidence is strong and striking enough that it can't be dismissed out of hand. At the very least, it seems to me, some kind of novel and as yet elusive explanatory framework is required to make sense of a president who not only obstinately refuses to focus on the central concern and source of disgruntlement among swing voters, the state of the economy, especially as it relates to the cost of living, which just so happens to be the central issue that propelled the president's reelection campaign 2 years ago, but who has repeatedly mocked the very concept of an affordability crisis as a scam, a hoax, and a con job concocted out of thin air by his Democratic foes. A president who plunged the country into a war in Iran that was screamingly unconsidered, ill-conceived, and just plain stupid from day one, and who's now running a playbook in that war destined to extend the conflict indefinitely into the future rather than cutting his and our losses and bringing it to a close. A president who continues to double down on policies and practices that have proven to be demonstrably and inarguably unpopular. For example, undercutting his own administration's pause on the non-emergency traffic stops by ICE that led to two more tragic and appalling shooting deaths in Biddeford, Maine, and Houston, Texas. A president who chose last week to demand a half hour of primetime TV real estate to indulge his own monomania and bottomless appetite for election-related conspiracy theories that precisely zero members of the Republican Party, besides him, believe it is in their interest to be talking about because they see no electoral upside in doing so. Quite the contrary. And all of that's before we even get to the astonishing array of self-enrichment schemes to which the president has devoted so much energy and done nothing to disguise, or the panoply of politically tin-eared, ineptly executed, and comically self-indulgent flights of fancy, from the cage match fighting on the White House lawn to the no-bid repainting of the National Mall reflecting pool that went so very well. All of those things that have consumed so many of his waking hours, when what ordinary voters would vastly prefer to see is a president occasionally focused on, or at least pretending to focus on, them. You know, doing his job. So, is Trump really trying to screw his own party with its pants on? Or does he simply not give a shit what happens to the GOP this fall? And more broadly, how should a vaguely rational person like me and you make sense of what we are seeing? To help answer those questions, or at a minimum, to help us grasp their full dimensions and perceptively and bemusedly mull them over, we are delighted to welcome back to the Impolitic Prefecture Peter Baker of the New York Times and Susan Glasser of the New Yorker, two longtime friends of the pod who, in addition to being the most high wattage journalistic power couple since Henry and Claire Booth Luce, bring to the table their trademark store of unimpeachable reportage, sharp, nuanced, wised up analysis, and delightfully companionable conviviality. All on this brand new episode of Impolitic with John Heilman that's coming at you in 3, 2, 1.
The only way you can negotiate with these people is through strength. And the only strength is military strength. And that's what we've done. And I mean, literally 2 days ago, we had a deal and then they broke it at the last moment. They broke it.
Will these strikes continue?
They'll continue until I say it's enough. We're going to hit them very hard tonight. We're going to hit them very hard tomorrow night. We're going to hit them very hard the night after. And then next week, it gets really bad for them because next week comes the power plants. Next week comes the bridges. We're going to knock out all their power plants. We're going to knock out all their bridges unless they get to the table and negotiate.
So there's Donald Trump talking about the war in Iran with an interviewer from Fox News who I'd never seen before. And Peter, Susan, it's good to see you guys. How are you?
Hey. We're good. Happy to see you, John.
It's been too long. It's been too long since I've had the Washington's reigning power couple, Baker and Glasser. At this moment, which of you is ranked higher on the power Washington power ranking scale, Glasser or Baker?
No, I'm just a stay-at-home book writer right now, John. So I think Peter's your guy.
Yes,
it just counts as power, man. We really downgraded the definition.
Well, you also didn't your son just graduate from college the other day?
He did, yes.
I thought that was rather exciting. I saw these social media posts about it, like Stanford, correct? Right, like yes. a really good school and a really expensive school.
They promised they're still going to send the diploma in the mail, so we'll wait till it arrives.
I'm surprised you guys still have a roof over your head after that tuition for 4 years. My God. It's just like, talk about that. Susan's like, I'm writing a book because we still have to pay the last tuition payment for our son. So here's the thing about Donald Trump and Iran. Peter, I'll ask you this question to start off, because I awoke this morning to a headline in the New York Times, your newspaper, that said, U.S. war against Iran enters a new phase. And I was called, what called to mind was the great philosopher Roger Daltrey singing, "Meet the new boss, same as the old boss." I'm like, meet the new phase, same as the old phase. I mean, Trump's on that clip threatening to blow up the bridges and the power plants again. It's like more war crimes being threatened. And then at the end of the interview, Trump is asked what message he's conveying to Iran at the negotiating table. And this is how he replies.
You better make a deal. You're not going to have anybody left. We're being very careful with the civilian population, as you know. But I said, you better make a deal. You're not going to have anything left.
Which sounds kind of like that infamous Truth Social post from a few months ago where Trump wrote, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back. Just like with less nakedly apocalyptic language and a more deflated tone. And Peter, You know, you've written about the box that Trump finds himself in, or I guess really the box that he's put himself in. But like, it does feel like we're just back to where we were before that long ceasefire. We're just we're at war again, right? That's the new phase. And the same things are bedeviling Trump that were bedeviling him then.
Right, and it's not like there's a new strategy here, right? What is the strategy? He hasn't articulated one, if there is, other than he's going to bomb again. Well, they bombed for something like 40 days at a very intense level at the beginning of this war, and that didn't cause Iran to buckle and give in to Trump to do everything that Trump wants him to do. He doesn't seem eager to get back to that level of warfare again. Certainly, Republican allies on the Hill don't want him to. So if he's not willing to go beyond what he already did, what will additional strikes that we've been seeing the last few days, even more escalated strikes, actually accomplish? That's not really very clear, because the Iranians don't seem eager or interested in you know, bowing down to him and giving him what he wants. So he's in a box, like you say, between, you know, a diplomatic strategy that hasn't worked and a military strategy that hadn't worked, and it's not clear where he goes from here to get to where he wants to go.
Susan, in the most recent piece that your husband wrote about this, he said that improvisation and impulse are not working. It seems like that, A, that's obviously true. But also, when you just, Trump's tone seems to be somewhere between, he realizes that. He doesn't have any other clubs in his bag, so to speak, besides those two things. And he seems to be somewhere between befuddled and super frustrated by that, but doesn't really know, like, where to turn and what to do, and that it's just weird to see him seeming as paralyzed and sort of stymied as it feels like with him going back and playing the greatest hits again in that interview.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's the Groundhog Day of war crimes threats, and it's because Donald Trump, you know, he's an 80-year-old guy who's put himself in a box of his own making, and he doesn't have that many plays. He doesn't have that many moves. Right. And so what's striking is that Trump has used to, in some venues, astonishing success, the technique of repetition, whether it's repeating a lie over and over again until millions of his followers believe it's the truth about the 2020 election. But in the context here of international relations, what he's doing is repeating over and over again a kind of series of threats that are grave in and of themselves, coming from a president of the United States who does, in fact, actually have the power to carry them out. And yet, Trump is devaluing his own currency by making these threats again and again and again, knowing he's unlikely to follow through. Donald Trump can't really afford, it seems to me, to have the resumption of full-scale war, to take some of the military options that he might, you know, on paper, be able to take to break this impasse with the Iranians. But he's not going to do it, because it would require ground troops, or it would require escalation that would wreak terrible damage on U.S. allies in the Gulf. Or it would, you know, the consequences of most of the actions you could conceive of him taking to get out of this mess are such that Donald Trump is left with increasingly hollow threats, because he doesn't seem to have a lot of other options. I would point out, too, that the Groundhog Day applies to how this has been covered by people. You know, the credulousness, I have to say, the credulousness of too many people, you know, is something that has enabled Trump to keep doing this. And, you know, on Fox News and all these other things, they treat it like it's on the level when Donald Trump says, we've got a ceasefire, it's a historic ceasefire, it's, you know, never been seen before, this kind of diplomatic memorandum of understanding with Iran. It collapsed on its own contradictions. If anything, it took longer to collapse than one might have imagined, because from the very beginning, Donald Trump claimed that the memorandum of understanding reopened the Strait of Hormuz, and Iran did not have control over it. And from the very beginning, Iran said, this memorandum of understanding solidifies our control over the Strait of Hormuz. So,
right. Your husband, again.
That's how a memorandum of understanding becomes a memorandum of misunderstanding.
Yes, I was literally about to quote that that line. It was the thing I liked best in your piece, Peter, your piece, the piece that you wrote, that headline of which was, in Iran, Trump has found an opponent he cannot easily dominate, which basically talked about The strategic bind that he's in, and had that line, and I thought, oh, that's nice. That was good. A memorandum of misunderstanding. Very, very, very well put. And thinking, and you know, Susan just raised the Strait of Hormuz, and I would like for you to please explain to me on the basis of your reportage and knowledge and instinct, what exactly happened in the 24 hours between Trump standing up and saying, we are now going to take charge of the Strait of Hormuz. We're going to be the guardian of the Strait. We are going to, in perpetuity, we will now be in charge of it. And we will now charge tolls and all because it's fair. We are going to get paid for safeguarding the Strait of Hormuz. And literally 24 hours later, him standing up and saying, no, you know what? Not just no, but and acknowledging the contradiction and saying, well, we've decided to back off that because of some reason. He basically said, so tried to claim that I've never liked the fees anyway. You know, I never liked them. And he made up some shit about how they were going to, instead of fees, there were going to be some investments in America that were going to come from, I don't know who. What took place that changed Trump's mind between day one and day two on that story?
I mean, by his own admission, he gets calls from Arab leaders, his friends in the Gulf, who say, what the heck? You know, this isn't what we were talking about. This is not something we agreed to. And this is something you, the president of America and your secretary of state and so forth, have repeatedly said you would never do. It's unacceptable. It's a violation of international law. So your pals in the region call you up and say, what are you doing? And he says, oh, I didn't mean to do that. And so, as you say, he comes up with this face-saving idea that, oh, well, they're going to invest a lot in America so he can pretend that he's still getting whatever kind of money he was going to get without any detail, any concrete, you know, it's just sort of clearly, you know, a face-saving statement, let's say, I guess.
Yeah, right. And Susan, here's my thing about this, right, which is the most fascinating thing about it to me was, well, actually not the first, not so much fascinating thing, but amusing thing about it was, as Peter just mentioned, it came just a couple weeks after our Secretary of State, Marco Antonio Rubio, had been rather clear and extremely emphatic on this topic.
Okay, if you're paying someone to go there, I don't care if you call it a fee or a toll or a donation, it's a toll. That's how we're going to define it. That's international waterway. There isn't a nation on earth that supports having to pay money to go through the straits. And think about it this way. If you have, first, it's not even workable. Let's suppose that we went crazy and lost our minds completely and decided to agree to have a tolling or a fee mechanism. How would that work? It's not doable. Because what's the consequence for not paying? Let's say a ship says, well, I'm not going to pay the fee. It's not like a toll on a road. You don't get a ticket in the mail. They get shot at. You shoot at one ship, you sink one ship, no other ship is going to move. So that sort of system is not only unwise, it can't happen, it's not even workable. So you might as well abandon the fantasy now.
I mean, that guy is making a lot of sense. Someone should introduce that guy to Donald Trump. But look, beyond the kind of hilarious conflict on display there, what really struck me was the world's reaction to Trump's pronouncement about the Strait, right? I mean, like China, India, Japan, Australia, Germany, France, like none of those countries was ever going to pay a 20% toll to the United States on cargo passing through the Strait of Hormuz. You know, like as Marco suggested there, like all of them would consider that idea outrageous for like a dozen different reasons. But the world didn't react with outrage. People just ignored it. There was like none of those allies I just mentioned stood up and said, oh, how outrageous what Donald Trump is suggesting here. That violates international law. They all just kind of shrugged and went, he's not serious. This is bullshit. It's not going to happen. And I think that is an extraordinary state of affairs. We say a lot of things about how Trump has changed the role of the United States in the world. But we are now in a place where the United States, when the president makes a statement of policy about something with grave international and global consequence, much of the world just goes, we don't take this seriously. We don't believe you, and we're not going to react to it as if it's a serious thing because it's clearly made up. That is an extraordinary state of affairs, one that I believe is entirely unprecedented in the history of the country.
Yeah, I mean, look, Donald Trump is the very definition of an unreliable narrator. And, you know, and so part of the problem is what does it mean when the president of the United States has announced a, you know, sweeping historic victory or a major breakthrough on this or that or the other thing? He's at a minimum devalued the currency of the presidential bully pulpit. But I think it's more than that, honestly. I mean, I think that it suggests that he is being played for a fool again and again and again, and those surrounding him. And my concern is that he has shown such a reckless willingness to use force in the second term without any kind of process surrounding it, without any kind of, you know, guardrails or constraints around it. And, you know, he's lucky this hasn't turned out even worse for the United States, for other Arab countries, for Israel, for Europe, which, by the way, and Asia, which were more impacted by the consequences of the huge spike in oil and energy prices. I think that's one underappreciated thing. People, America here is so understandably self-obsessed with our own internal divisions and our own economic instability. But the truth is like Donald Trump, you know, wakes up with a brain fart and, you know, there are lines all over Europe, gas lines all over Europe, and they're canceling literally thousands of flights because, you know, European airlines and Asian airlines can't afford to fly their routes. That's because Donald Trump acted irresponsibly on, you know, this or that day. And so I think this is something that's truly different. There was a lot of alarm in Trump's first term, but now it's about taking actions that in a moment's notice can destabilize the world economy.
Peter, I quoted a piece of your, I quoted a piece of yours to Susan, so I'll now quote a piece of Susan's back to you. And I will note that Susan, your absence in the pages of the New Yorker, the regular appearances in the pages of the New Yorker has been noted in this household, and we are like, what the fuck is going on with Susan Glasser? Now it turns out I learned you were writing a book, and okay, fine, but you know, could you please get on with that and get the book done and get back into the magazine so we can read you every week? But a piece you wrote not that long ago, back in April, I believe, talked about how Trump isn't just an unreliable narrator, as you just said, but that he's no longer a reliable counterparty, essentially. The headline on that piece was Trump in the Iran deal that wasn't. And the subhead was, it's tough to reach an agreement with a president whose word is not his bond. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons. It's nearly impossible to put much stock in anything Trump says at this point. But one of them is how often and how kind of flagrantly he contradicts himself. Like, you know, one day he's saying that Iran's leadership is, quote, much less radicalized and far more intelligent. You know, they're more reasonable. They're more rational. We can do business with these guys. And then the next day, we hear him saying,
I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people.
And Peter, the question I wanted to ask you, keying off of Susan's point about Trump's unreliability, is whether the world is starting to see America itself as an unreliable counterparty and is kind of moving on from an international order based on America being the stable, solid bedrock that everything else rests on.
Yeah, I think that the world is moving on some level. I think you're right. I mean, for the whole 70, 80 years after World War II, we had Republican and Democratic presidents in roughly equal amount of time, by the way. Each party held the White House for almost exactly 50% of the time since World War II. And the consistency throughout on foreign policy, while obviously there were important variations along the way, was pretty important to the world because they knew, they thought they understood where America was going to end up on this issue or that issue because there was sort of a broad consistency. Again, you know, they're outliers, right? I mean, Jimmy Carter did things differently than George W. Bush would have done them. But broadly speaking, they understood that America played the role it played as an anchor in the Western Alliance, as an enforcer of international rules and order and all of that kind of thing. And now they're saying none of that really applies. So you talk to European leaders, they are very committed to the idea that they have to figure out their own way forward. They can no longer rely on America. Now there's, by the way, perhaps there's some advantage to that. Maybe it's not bad for some of these countries to, you know, fortify themselves and to do more to find their own place. And Europe should probably, every president prior to Trump actually wanted Europe to do more to, you know, defend itself and to take leadership. I mean, I remember when Obama was president, he wanted Europe to take the lead in the Libya war. Europe really couldn't do it. In the end, of course, America had to step in as it always has. So if the rest of the world is coming around to the idea that you can't rely on America, it's not going to always be there for you, there is arguably an upside. But broadly speaking, for America, it means we've sacrificed, you know, a great deal of influence, a great deal of power in the world because of our word, because people knew where we were coming from, because they thought they could rely on us. And right now they feel like we have a leader who's mercurial and unpredictable and says one thing one day and will change his mind a day later.
Yeah. And I mean, Susan, when Trump isn't trashing our European allies, as he does so often, he likes to take credit for getting them to increase their contributions to NATO, right? And to spend more on their own defense. And to Peter's point, like, okay, you know, I can see the advantage to that, sure. But at the leadership levels in Europe and in Asia, both in companies and in government, there's this sense, and Mark Carney kind of enunciated this at Davos a few months ago, but the sense that the American age is over, you know, from World War II until, you know, yet the day before yesterday, we were living in the American era, the American age, right? And that is now over. We don't know what's going to replace it, but that is now over. And despite what Donald Trump and many of the people in MAGA say, that age was pretty good for America. I mean, America did pretty well in the American age. It was not the American age, but we also were getting ripped off all the time and our standards of living were suffering and we had very little influence in the world, quite to the contrary. So I can't see how you could look at this and say, and I mean, you can look for a few places in which it might not be the most terrible thing, but on the largest scale, it seems like somewhere between a pretty bad thing and a catastrophe.
Well, that's why the term superpower suicide has been bandied about. You know, look, first of all, by the way, John, thank you for the kind words. Just to be clear, yes, I am on book leave, but I am planning to come back and start writing my letter from Trump's Washington for The New Yorker every week starting in the fall. But Peter and I are doing this book, which is very relevant to your point, is it's a history of Vladimir Putin and the five American presidents from Bill Clinton up to Donald Trump who've struggled to deal with him and really struggled to deal with the idea that this great story we told ourselves about the end of the Cold War, that it was over and we won, that, you know, that wasn't, we just didn't want to believe that we were going to be right back at, you know, confronting an adversarial, great power, nuclear-threatening Russia that wanted to restore its empire. And I think that, unfortunately, is the reality of Europe today. So you ask the question about, you know, what is Trump doing in blowing up our relationship with our allies and partners and friends in Canada and Europe? It's not Donald Trump who's caused primarily, I think, European countries to spend more on their defense. The guy who has brought Europe together and gotten them serious is Vladimir Putin. And by unleashing this horrible, deadly, awful, violent war in Europe, the deadliest war on the continent since the end of World War II, you know, they are the front lines in ways that, you know, like the United States under all these different presidents, many European leaders didn't want to acknowledge that this was where things were headed. They created a strategy of engagement with Russia and with Putin after he came to power because that's what they wanted to believe. And right. It was in some ways us talking to ourselves and not understanding, you know, the world as it had become. With this very, very committed, you know, Russian imperialist, great power leader. That's who Vladimir Putin is, reestablishing a dictatorship in Russia. And so I think it is important to note that it's Putin who's brought Europe together. But I will say the other big blow to Europe in recent years has been the simultaneous withdrawal of the United States for the U.S. not being the liberal guarantor that we thought it was, And so it's prompted, Trump has prompted a kind of major rethinking, I think, in his second term. Mark Carney talking about the middle powers. At one point, it was really shocking to a lot of people when Carney, a very measured, you know, former central banker, said, I think I would trust China's word more than the United States. Yes. And I just saw just yesterday a senior Pentagon official, one of the architects of Trump's foreign policy strategy, Bridge Colby, arguing with Carney on Twitter. Fascinating dialogue in which, you know, he's basically saying, oh, these bullshit middle powers, you know, what do they know? You know, they can't leave us. You know, we're people, countries from around the world are still knocking down our doors to try to buy American defense technology and be under our umbrella. I think they're overconfident that they can still get away with no consequences and no accountability for Donald Trump's actions. And I think that's the reason why Colby and so many other Republicans, you know, they get in line with a guy they know is reckless, dangerous, untruthful, and doing things that are damaging to American national security because they think they can get away with it, frankly.
Right. So, first of all, so thrilled to hear that that the book in question is a Glasser Baker joint, number one. And number two, and number two, that's a great book topic. So I couldn't be, it's a brilliant way of writing about Putin in a way that nobody else has, and you guys are as well situated and well qualified to do it as anybody. So I'm going to count on the fact that you're not going to let me down and turn it a shitty book because, you know, you're you. You guys don't do that. I'm psyched for it to come out. Do we have a title?
No.
Not yet. Okay. All right. So we'll brainstorm.
Strong consensus on that.
We'll brainstorm on that one on a later occasion. We got to take a break. So that is what we're going to do. And then we will shift our focus away from Trump and Ford affairs to Trump on the home front when we come back right after these words.
Sometimes it feels like the news is full of things that have never happened before. And that is not exactly true. In fact, it may have happened this very week, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I'm Sally Helm, host of the podcast History This Week from the History Channel. Trade embargoes? Thomas Jefferson tried them. Rent too high? We've been arguing about that for a while. Each episode is proof. The past isn't that far away. Listen to History This Week, available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It will concern that subject, and we'll have a couple of other things to
Why
say.
Should people
also,
watch, though?
But I'd rather save it, but it's really big news. It's really, really big news. And our country has to shape up. But that's what we're going to be talking about Thursday is it doesn't get bigger because without free and fair elections, you don't have a country. We'll be discussing other things, too. But it's going to be a very big announcement. Yeah.
So that was Donald Trump at an Oval Office gaggle being asked about his primetime address on election security. And I should say here, full disclosure, we are taping this before that speech happens. So we won't be commenting on it, on its specifics or its details. And, I don't really think it's that big a problem for a couple reasons, right? Number one, I would bet every dollar of the advance that you guys got paid for your Putin Five Presidents book that, contrary to what we just heard Trump say, there will be no big or real news in the speech. Not like even a little bit, not one iota. And number two, I'd also bet that most of our listeners will have forgotten all about the speech by the time this episode drops on Monday morning, except for one thing, except for the fact that it was yet another attempt by Trump to undermine public confidence in our election system and to lay down a pretext for declaring the midterms to have been rigged if Republicans lose the House and or Senate. Because, I feel like I can say that with confidence because we've learned over the past 10 years that is Donald Trump's jam. And that means basically, you know, that the three of us here, we can talk about the speech in broad strokes without even having heard it. So I want to start by asking both of you this, but I'll start with Peter. I would say at this juncture, there's a broad consensus view among Democrats that Trump is going to try to mess with the midterms in some way. And my question is, when you talk to your sources in D.C., like, what do they imagine that's actually going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you need to look at is the totality of what he's doing, right? Whatever is said in the speech, and we should not predict, as you rightly say, nobody can ever know for sure what Trump may say at any given time. But the broad stroke, you're right, is we know he's trying to discredit the idea of free and fair elections in this country. So he does it repeatedly, and he does it emphatically. And the question is why? Okay, is it just about finding a way to salve his wounds over losing in 2020 by pretending that he actually won and convincing other people that he actually won, and he can't be a loser in his world? There's nothing worse than ever being a loser. Is it just about, you know, that sort of ego, you know, satisfaction? Or is there something more insidious involved, right? And in Washington, certainly the Democratic side of the aisle, some on the Republican side, are wondering whether this is part of a broader plan that he's got in store for the fall to not just discredit the results of an election his party is likely to lose, but to try to actually do something about it. They just removed the appointees from this election administration board that's supposed to help states and localities, you know, run clean elections. You know, he has pushed this voting restriction bill that would, you know, require not just require IDs, but do other things to make it harder for people to vote. That's not going to pass. There are not the votes to do it. The fact that he keeps saying it over and over again. Why does he say it over and over again? In order to therefore lay the groundwork to say, well, they didn't pass my bill, therefore we can't trust these elections. It's you know, we see the playbook. The question is how far he's willing to go with it. Is it just about, you know, creating public impression and having excuses for what may be an election loss? Or is there a plan to actually operationalize this in some ways? And I'll leave you with one other thought. At the end of the 2020 election, when he was thinking about what to do after he had lost and how to try to find a way to reverse it, he had a meeting in the Oval Office with Mike Flynn and a few other people. And Mike Flynn told him, Mike Flynn was, of course, the retired lieutenant general who had been his national security advisor for 24 days before being fired and later convicted, eventually pardoned. And he suggested the president have troops go seize voting machines in the 6 swing states he lost so he could rerun the election until he wins, right? Trump didn't go along with that, maybe because at that time the chief of the military was Mark Milley, a very outspoken defender of the rules-based order who would not have gone along with it. Is that something that Trump has in mind this time? Well, we asked him this. My colleagues asked him this in January at an interview, and he said he regretted not doing what Flynn said he should do. So that's an important data point that doesn't get stressed enough, I think, that he has said he should have used the military to seize voting machines in states that he lost. Not states that he won, by the way, just the ones he lost. Those are the only ones, of course, that it would have to be rerun. And he has said on occasion that there are 15, I think he said 15, right, Sue, places that we know we cannot trust elections, which, again, sounds like he's leading up to something.
Right. Well, and I was going to cite that interview, Peter. I will also say the thing you're talking about.
We're on the same length here. We're
well, it was very striking, you know, because he said he regretted it, and the thing you were talking about there, he fired the 3 remaining members. It's a 4, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, which is let's be fair, not a heavy hitting agency in Washington, but a bipartisan agency, has 2, supposed to have 2 Republican members, 2 Democratic members. One of the Republicans had already resigned. So Trump fired the 2 remaining Democrats and the 1 remaining Republican. So that agency no longer exists. Again, I'm not sure the impact of that is going to be all that great. But Susan, he is also, you know, clearly, you know, through the Postmaster General, trying to get a hold of voter rolls. All over the country. We know what he's done in Georgia. He went down and seized voter rolls there. The full shape of what the strategy and the tactics are is not yet clear. But those things in combination with the recent and repeated reference, invocation of the word emergency, when he talks about the SAVE Act and why he wants it passed, he says it's an emergency, as if like he's starting to test out the rhetoric of declaring a national emergency around the elections and doing something. And I guess my question is, given all of that mood music and actual actions that he's taking, what are Democrats who all believe he's going to do something
And it's not going to be, it's not just going to be discrediting the election rhetorically, but he's going to try to meddle with it, mess with it. That's what they all believe. Do you see any signs that, they all say we're getting ready, but do you see any signs that Democrats are actually doing anything that is concrete and actionable to try to blunt that assault or deal with it if it happens?
Yeah, this is such a great question, John. Really, I think it is the question because, you know, remember that in 2020, Donald Trump also foreshadowed his actions, and he not only preemptively undermined the legitimacy of the 2020 election, but he made it very clear he was willing to take, you know, unspecified but very serious steps. And yet, when he ran the play in the end, Democrats, I think, were hornswoggled by the brazenness of it in ways that they hadn't anticipated, right? I mean, even like I was very much in a kind of like worried, dark place at that time. And yet, did it occur to me? Did it occur to the, you know, critics of Trump that I was speaking with that they would just disregard the December 14th date by which states need to certify their ballots, you know, after a presidential election and just... No, I mean, you know, nobody thought you could do that. And I think, you know, did the Democrats take seriously in 2020 the idea that we're just going to have like fake electoral certificates? No, because that's crazy. And, you know, it's bullshit and it's not legal. And so I think that is always going to be this asymmetrical advantage for Trump and those surrounding him who abet him in these kind of schemes, is that he's willing to contemplate things that literally seem absurd on their face. So that's one issue. I think another issue.
Nobody had an assault on the Capitol on January 6th on their bingo card. Even the most paranoid, alarmed of us who are like, you better watch out. All kinds of crazy shit could happen. Exactly. It was not like, oh, and they might just storm the Capitol on January 6th.
Right, because and actually Trump tried to seize the actual electoral system.
Right. I'm like, God, I missed that one. Shit.
You know, I remember, right, like watching that horrible day play out. And do you remember there were, I think there were two young women who were carrying that box with the actual electoral certificates through the Capitol as the as the riot was happening. And I remember they're like, oh, well, thank goodness they got that. And even as we watched it unfold, it still seemed unthinkable that those goons who were rampaging through the Capitol that actually might have had in mind to seize the physical certificates from the state. And
totally.
Yet, yeah. You know, perhaps they did. So another point that I think is very important that goes directly to your question is about Democrats. What is it they're doing? Certainly, I have been assured, I'm sure you have as well, oh, lawyers are meeting, you know, important discussions are taking place. But I also have continued to hear from many Democrats, including, you know, strategists who are very senior, well-placed in the party, I think deep down, too many of them really just believe that Donald Trump and the Republicans are in a big hole going into the election, and that somehow they're going to get out of this mess because they're going to win so big that Trump won't be able to steal it from them.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of them think.
Yeah.
And I for the last 10 years, frankly, at every key moment, you've heard a lot of rhetoric from people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris about the existential threat that Donald Trump poses to American democracy. But their actions, again and again and again, have not matched up with that rhetoric.
Susan, I can't tell you the number of Democrats I've heard cite Trump's phrase from 2024. Well, let's just make it too big to rig, right? And you know what? Too big to rig, if you believe there's a rigging threat, too big to rig is a very actionable strategy if the other side is not trying to rig it. It's like it's too big to rig if Democrats aren't actually trying to meddle with the election, which was the case in 2024 and has been the case throughout all of our lifetimes. But is it, what does too big to rig mean if the other side is the president of the United States and the party that controls the majority in the House and Senate? and controls increasingly election boards all around the country and has control of the National Guard and has control of the military. I mean, that's just like what too big to rig means if you have a determined and empowered opponent on the other side trying to rig it is a really different thing. It gives me no comfort to hear some people, well, we'll just make it too big to rig. It's like, I don't know. I'm not sure that anything's too big to rig in that circumstance, or at least not too big, so big that it would somehow deter. Donald Trump's not going to look up on election night and go, yeah, you know what? We had a plus six shift to Democrats across the country, and they won. They, you know, they have a net 45 seat gain in the House. That's too big to mess with. That's not the way Donald Trump's going to think about this.
Let me play out one other variation on this. Let's just play benefit of the doubt and say that they're not going to rig it, that they can't rig it, or it's too big to rig, or this is just paranoid conspiracy theories on the left. Either way, there is a cost, because what it means is we have a lack of faith in the system, right? It was the Republicans who lost their faith that our elections were fair because Donald Trump told them to lose that faith, because he told them that they were rigged, because he told them that 2020 was stolen. So if you look at polls, you see Republicans for years have said, I'm not sure I can trust our democracy. And now what you have is Democrats. Polls show now Democrats are losing their faith to some extent that the elections will be free and fair.
Yeah.
And so even if they are free and fair across the board, 50 states, all these different communities, let's just say that everybody does it right and there is no problem and nobody actually does anything untoward, a lot of Americans just aren't going to believe it. And the idea that we could have a result that people don't trust, one way or the other, you know, Republicans win, I don't trust that, that can't possibly be legit, says a Democrat, and vice versa. It means that going forward, we don't invest in our leadership, our government, the credibility of a public election, right?
I mean, legitimacy, if you assume public office, having legitimacy, which is to say that at least all but the kookiest people out there in your constituency, whatever that constituency is, statewide, congressional, presidential, having them all believe that, you know, that you want it fair and square is really important to get anything done. As the political actor, if you don't have, and very hard to get anything done if you don't have it, if you have half of your constituency thinking that the fix was in.
We got to sneak in another break, and this seems like a good time to do it. So let's take care of that piece of business, and then we'll come back and we'll pick up right here with Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, the John and Yoko, the Kurt and Courtney. I don't know, the Ike and Tina Turner. I don't know. Sonny and Cher. The Sonny and Cher of political journalism, Mom. So everybody just stick around.
He fears defeat in the midterms, and that explains his spiral into conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories that put Georgia Republicans in a terrible bind. Because now not only do they have to defend this president's economic record, not only do they have to defend doubling health insurance premiums for more than a million Georgians, they also have to defend all of these bizarre conspiracy theories coming out of the White House. I don't know of Republican colleagues who agree with the president on this. Privately, most elected Republicans in this building think the president has lost it and is dooming them to dismal losses this fall.
So that was John Ossoff taking questions from reporters on Capitol Hill right around the time that rumors were running wild in right-wing media that Trump was going to use his primetime address to declare that the elections of both Ossoff and his fellow Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock, which, as I'm sure you guys recall, both happened on January 5th, 2021, in runoff elections where those guys flipped both of their states, Senate seats from red to blue. The rumor was that Trump's going to declare them illegitimate in some way. And Susan, Ossoff, in what he said there, is getting at the heart of what I want to ask you about, which is kind of the practical political ramifications of Trump's decision to put this rigged election obsession of his front and center once again with this speech. It's a decision that like comes on top of another piece of Trump-driven news that's in the headlines right now with unhelpful political implications for Republicans. These ICE killings in Maine and in Texas, which just happen to be states where two of the most important Senate races this year are taking place. And, you know, I mean, just to put this simply, like, you know, the thought I had was, does Susan Collins want to be talking about election fraud, conspiracy theories, and about an out of control ICE in the state of Maine?
Is that what she wants to be talking about as she tries to hold on to her seat? Is that even what Ken Paxton wants to be talking about in Texas, a state where if Ken Paxton loses and James Tallarico wins, it's going to be in large measure and in non-insignificant measure because Donald Trump's ICE policies have cost him the support of so many Hispanic voters over the course of the last 18 months. And that's before you even get to the biggest political drag Trump has placed on every Republican who's in a competitive race, the war on Iran, right? And its effect on the economy, which I'll say, you know, was why you can almost hear the entire congressional wing of the GOP screaming into like one big pillow when the ceasefire collapsed and the bombing started up again. And, you know, a lot of shit has happened, you know? The Graham Platner thing has happened. We can talk a little bit more about that. Various things. It's like the moment when you think
a lot of shit has
Democrats
happened.
Are, yeah, really, a lot of shit has happened. There was a great Barack Obama quote from 2008 that we put in Game Changer that I always think about, which is this shit would be really interesting if it wasn't really happening.
Sorry, I remember that.
or this shit would be really interesting if we weren't in the middle of it, I think is right. Actually the quote, which is a kind of an incredible quote. But like, you know, various things have happened. Setback. Whenever Democrats have felt in the last few months like, hey, really, the House is in the bag and maybe we'll get the Senate, something goes off the rails. You know, Graham Platner goes off the rails or whatever, or the Voting Rights Act gets tossed out and there's, you know, snap redistricting is taking place, whatever. Yeah, but at this moment, it does feel like Trump is foregrounding all of the wrong stuff. And it does raise the question, A, of what the consequence of that will be. And B, whether Trump actually cares.
Well, so I think your observation is captures sort of the weird dichotomy of this election, because Trump in his own way seems to be doing everything possible to help the Democrats. You know, I mean, having a war in the Middle East that drives up prices for every freaking thing when people are already hysterical about the cost of things in America, you know, calling it a made up affordability crisis, you know, basically sending goons into communities around the country and having them shoot people, you know, in their cars. I mean, it's pretty crazy stuff. And yet it's sort of contradicted by the fact that Trump, if he doesn't care about whether Republicans win the election, midterm elections, then why is he so goddamn obsessed with them? So he actually came into office last year talking even earlier than he did in his first term about the midterm elections. He had not right. one, but two different executive orders about the midterm elections. Yeah. He's going on about mail-in voting. He said that his bill to change the rules, essentially, of voting to federalize elections in ways that seemed at odds with the Constitution, giving that responsibility to the states. All of that speaks to an obsession with these midterm elections, which is not wholly explained simply by his desire to wash away the stain of his 2020 defeat in a, you know, kind of morass of conspiracy theories and lies about, you know, what happened in his, you know, previous elections, right? He actually does seem obsessed with these midterm elections. Maybe it's because he has always thought he was going to lose the midterm elections. And so he's in a kind of a preemptive, you know, temper tantrum about them. But I do think these things are somewhat at odds with each other for somebody yeah. who is doing things politically. But remember, Donald Trump, you know, basically has very little respect for the kind of political class, even on his own side. He thinks they dismissed him yeah. as a political figure. He thinks he knows better about the elections. He's always foregrounded, love that word that you use. He's always foregrounded issues of the credibility of elections. And I remember, you know, his obsession with the 2020 election. I mean, his own advisors, both political advisors, legal advisors, you know, personal advisors, they all were like, it wasn't their thing. It was Donald Trump's thing personally. Yeah. And so I think he believes that he has already created a one-man system of government, at least inside the Republican Party and inside his own administration, John.
Yeah.
So a lot of this is he could give a shit yeah. about anybody other than him. And he yeah. thinks if he calls it an issue, remember, this has come up during some of the Republican infighting over the last year, over Epstein, over the Iran war. Tucker Carlson breaks with Donald Trump. What does he say? He says, they're not MAGA. I'm MAGA. MAGA is whatever I say it is.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump says the campaign in 2026 is whatever the hell issues I say it is.
Yeah. There's that. I don't speak French, but there's that the state is me thing famously.
Passez-moi.
There you go. See, like whenever I try to sound like whenever I try to speak a French sentence, I sound like Steve Martin talking about a cheese omelette. It's like omelette du fromage. Peter, there's another part of that Ossoff clip though that made me think specifically of you, because Ossoff says, you know, if you ask my Republican colleagues in the Senate privately, they all think Trump's lost it. And it made me think of you because much to your
because I've lost it.
Well, you know, I'll leave that for another day. Because I say much to your credit, you have been one of the rare national political policy Washington reporters who's kind of come back and written in a serious substantive way and come back to it on more than one occasion of Trump's declining cognitive capacity. And I remember, I'm almost certain I remember you writing in the fall of 2024 after Biden was off the ticket. You're like, you know, you in a very even-handed, serious reportorial way, you're like, well, if Joe Biden was suffering from various kinds of declines, there's not been as much of a focus on Donald Trump, and some people are now focusing on it more. And I guess my first question is do you think Ossoff is a reliable narrator there when he says that most of his Republican colleagues think Trump has lost it? Is that the kind of view of most Republicans in private that you run into and talk to, report on in Washington? And what's your observation of Trump's? I'm not asking about for psychological analysis here. The things that there is, it's clear distinction between cognitive decline and being bonkers. Bonkers is a thing we can't really rule on. But when a president exhibits a shrinking vocabulary, increasing confusion about countries, when he says we're at war with the Islamic Republic of Japan, these are things that we can comment on because they're there. So I'm curious about what you think about the prevailing view of Trump's mental situation state among Republicans, number one, and number two, what your sense is of whether he has exhibited increasingly notable signs of decline in his second term.
It's a good question. And I think it's an important question, by the way. I thought it was important that we address these with Biden, and we did. Contrary to the mythology that it didn't come up until the debate, I think the media, certainly the New York Times, wrote and explored these issues. And then I think it's also a case to be made that things changed over the course of his 4 years as well, became more pronounced, right? Well, that's the question now. Is there a change? And that's a good question. John Ossoff obviously is a partisan Democrat, so one should discount that statement as a reflection of fact. But I think it's and I don't know that the Republicans I talk to, I would say most, but I would say that a not insignificant number of Republicans that you would talk to off the record, including office holders, would think that, yes. And I think that they are concerned about that. There is this argument, of course, about, well, he's always been, you use the word bonkers, I'm not going to use it, but he's always been who he is, right? He's always been mercurial, volatile, unpredictable, a little off kilter compared to normal politicians, and is no different than he always has been. It's just that we are, grappling with it. And then there are those who say, no, actually, there is a progression here that is not the same as it was 10 years ago. And I think if you go back and listen to speeches, for instance, from his 2016 race or his early months of the first term, I do think there's a difference here. I do think you notice a difference. And I think that's not surprising. Of course, he's 80 years old. This is the issue that when we're going to have a gerontocracy leadership, whether it be in the Senate or in the White House, this is what we're going to have to deal with. And we're going to measure that. The problem is there's no way to address it. Short of him being in a coma, right, there is no mechanism that exists for a president who is, losing steam, losing his fastball, whatever you want to say, being addressed, because no vice president, currently in the current era, is going to invoke the 25th Amendment if you can't, because it would be seen as a coup. And if you can't get the vice president to do it, then the 25th Amendment doesn't work. Right. And so what do you do about that? But I do think you hear increased concerns about that among Republicans who think he has, he's slipping, he's sliding, and that he's Look what he's done in the Iran stuff. The some of the things he has said have been just really out there. And it's not that long ago that he was comparing himself to the Pope, and he was, or Jesus, or, you know, all these memes that he likes to adopt, and they don't seem very stable. So, you know, whether he is or not, he's certainly giving that impression to a lot of people. And now his defenders would say that's strategy, right? It's the old Nixon madman's theory. But what if it's not a fake? You know, I mean, that's the question that foreign leaders, coming back to your earlier question, have to kind of grapple with.
All right. So there are a lot of things that left here on the table that we could discuss, but we're tight on time. And so here's the pivot I'm going to get, Susan, to you. On this last question, which relates to the state of Maine, which I alluded to earlier. The Maine Democratic Party is having a convention on July the 25th, I believe. It's not very far from now, where they're going to try to choose a replacement for Graham Plattner. And the pivot I'm making is to say we're going to go from one toxic example of toxic masculinity in Donald Trump to another example of toxic masculinity in Graham Plattner. I've been eager throughout, and I have done this with basically every woman in my life, whether they've been in my personal life or a guest on the podcast over the course of the last 9 months. I'm always like, what do you think about Graham Plattner? I did this back in October, in November, December, whatever. You did the New Yorker, your political scene podcast with your colleagues, Ms. Mayer and Mr. Osnos. And the title of that podcast was The Plattner Implosion and What It Means for Democrats. I would like to know your thoughts about Graham Plattner and whether you were one of these people who, like, again, many women, there's a big stark distinction between women and men in my life, where women are like, I thought that guy seemed pretty fucking skeevy from day one. And some of them said it out loud and some of them didn't. I'm curious whether you're in that camp. And I'd like you to answer the question that you guys raised in the podcast, which is, what does it mean, his departure from the race, mean for Democrats, not just in Maine, but nationally?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think Peter will back me up on this. I definitely was one of those women, and I definitely from the beginning said it out loud.
I can attest to that.
So Susan, the things that Susan thinks she generally says out loud is my impression around the house, right, Peter? She's not like, there's not a lot of things where she's going to like, I have a very strong feeling about this, but I'm not going to express it.
not a lot gets left unsaid.
Right.
What? Wait a minute here.
I'm saying that in a complimentary way. I'm saying that in a
lots of opinions that nobody that you
that's
haven't.
A good thing.
I'm saying that in a complimentary way, not a negative way. I'm like, Susan, you're brilliant. So I want your thought. No, but if you have a thought, I want it to come out of your mouth.
Oh, please. No, fair. Look, Plattner, it just struck me, we're living in this age of, you know, increasingly calcified and, in my view, debilitating partisanship and polarization, and it's bad for the brain. It's bad for the brain. And we all know here, and, you know, we're independent journalists, so, you know, maybe it's easier for us to recognize this, but, you know, if Republicans had a candidate with a Nazi tattoo and, you know, posted those kinds of things on the internet about women and, you know, had this personal history and, you know, this, come on. I mean, it takes zero imagination to understand how all of the partisan Democrats in your life would have reacted to that fact set, exact fact set of Graham Plattner in a Republican candidate. And, you know, we saw some version of that play out, I think, with Joe Biden. And his decision to run again for re-election, despite it being, you know, very clear to so many Democrats, never mind the rest of the country, that he was not up to serving until he was 86 years old. And, oh, my God, you know, I was really having flashbacks as this Graham Plattner situation went to its almost inevitable, in my view, denouement, you know, with the same sort of rationalizations that we heard before. And it's just like, A, it's a reminder that kind of extreme, you know, I'll make any excuse for my team because we have no choice in this era of team sports, that usually works out poorly for your team. And, you know, that it's a reminder that calling it like you see it is actually generally going to be the best course of action anyways. And, you know, we did an event, a live event of our podcast a few weeks back with our editor, David Remnick. And this is before the final revelations from Politico about the sexual assault allegation. But already there was more than enough material. And David, you know, was asked about it. And he just said, I like this reason. He said, you know, it's just... It's a journey I choose not to be on. You know, why would you choose to go on this road with this man? You know, of all the people in the world, you know, why would Democrats go for this and then defend this very obviously flawed choice? It seems to me that given everything that had transpired and the fact that the Democrats stuck with him through the primary, that they got lucky as hell. That Politico story came out when it did, and that it was before this July 13th deadline to get Plattner off the ballot. Now, the challenge for Democrats, and I don't pretend to be any kind of an expert about, you know, the internal dynamics of the main Democratic Party and what's going to happen in that process, but the challenge here is one that's actually quite familiar to us all, I think, from the last 10 years of this Trump era, which is very simply generic Democratic candidate, I think, beats Susan Collins in this year.
That's what the polling indicates.
Exactly. And look, my view was like, you know, the jig was up for her. You know, the dance of like, I'm not really for Trump, but I'm not really against him. And yet enabling him to, you know, and his party to do so many things that were antithetical to what she claimed to believe in. Like that dance was over, in part because she's also kind of aged out of it, I think. She seems increasingly, you know, really not up to it. But generic Democrat probably would have kicked Donald Trump's ass in 2024 too. But they couldn't nominate and did not nominate a generic Democrat. And I don't know if any of these candidates, will fit the suit of generic enough Democrat, to really make the race about Donald Trump and Susan Collins. If it's about that, they'll win.
Peter Baker, Susan Glasser, nothing generic about the two of you, God knows, thankfully. It's great to see you. And thank you for, as always, dumping like more wisdom on my head in the course of an hour than I normally get in my average week. Appreciate it. The book, I'm going to be spending a lot of time thinking about this title issue. All I needed to know, actually, when it comes to titling things, not knowing any of the details of the book is actually helpful. It's just Vladimir Putin and five presidents. That's all I like. Because if I know more than that, it just gets too complicated. It's going to be a really boring title. But, you know, it's going to be like, you know, top five, you know, the Vladimir Putin and the U.S. president story. But I'm going to work on it.
I'm excited about that. Please, we look forward to your notes. We promise to give full credit to the winning title. And if any of your listeners
are in a contest,
right? It'll be really funny.
Presidential pips.
Right.
Well, yeah, I will. My one sneak preview is that it's not the greatest story. I wouldn't say that we, you know, like the Oval Office comes out, you know, smashingly well in this. Yeah,
this is not the feel good story of the summer, is what you're saying.
This is great. Peter, maybe we got a title for the book out of this.
I like it.
Guys, thank you. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Good talking to you. You're great.
John.
In Politics with John Heilman is a Puck podcast in partnership with Odyssey. Thanks again to Peter Baker and Susan Glasser for coming back on the show. If you enjoyed this episode of the show, please follow In Politics with John Heilman. Share us, rate us, and review us on the free Odyssey app or wherever you happen to bask in the splendor of the podcast universe. I am John Heilman, special correspondent for Puck. To read my stuff along with the reporting and analysis of all my fabulous Puck partners, go to puck.news/jheil, J-H-E-I-L, and subscribe, please. Speaking of my colleagues, John Kelly and Ben Landy are executive producers of In Politics. Lori Blackford is our guest wrangling guru. And Bob Tabador is our very own Rick Rubin, Brian Eno, Steve Albini, and the Bomb Squad, all rolled into one. Flawlessly producing, editing, mixing, and mastering this show, all by his lonesome and in no time flat. From all of us to all of you, a little mashup of a pair of late greats, my mom, and Bob Marley. Don't get arrested, don't get dead, and don't give up the fight.